There are a lot of good questions in the Bible. If we just made a list of all the questions that were raised by different people in the Bible, we could probably study those and find all kinds of interesting lessons from them. There was a question that was asked in the Garden of Eden. The devil said, "Hath God said, ye shall not eat of any tree of the garden?" He was trying to create doubt and confusion in Eve's mind. He wasn't asking for information. There was another question that was asked, too, in the garden. Cain, who was the first man born into the world, was also the first murderer. And he had just killed his brother, and God asked him, he said, "Where's your brother?" He wasn't asking for information either. I think he was trying to get a conviction. Another question was raised by a very faithful man named Job, as he went through a lot of suffering. And he raised the question, if a man dies, shall he live again? And I think he was looking for information. He wanted to know. Jesus tried to impress the importance of us being of the value of a man's soul on his disciples when he said, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?" There's another question, too, that I want you to think about tonight. And it was one that was asked by David, who is the king of Israel. And it's back in 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 39. As he sat by a gate in a town called Mahanaim. I'm sure that's probably not the right way to pronounce it, but that's the best I can do. And a messenger came back from battle to David, and he asked the question, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" David said, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And that's a question for us to consider tonight. David was a great king, greatest king of Israel, probably. And from the stories that we have of him in his youth, he was very faithful, he cared for the sheep that belonged to his father. In his battle against Goliath, he had great victories for Saul against many of the enemies of Israel. He was very honorable in his conduct during the wake of Saul's hatred for him. And even to the time that David was crowned king and all the battles that he would win, he was what we would call a spiritual giant. But for all of the fame and greatness of David, God chose to spend the latter part of 2 Samuel, the second part of Samuel's second book, telling about David's failures. And there's a practical lesson. There must have been a practical lesson in that for Israel, for God to have devoted that much space in the Bible to discussing the failures of David. And there's probably a good lesson for us, too, for him to devote that time. So, I want us to think about this question. Is it well with the young man's Absalom? What's really surprising, if you know the story, if you don't, we're going to recount it in just a moment. What's really surprising is that David would have even cared whether Absalom was well or whether or not he was dead. Because Absalom was really a wicked person, and he was an ungrateful son. And there are three things he did that maybe if you remember that really make it surprising that David even cared. First thing was, he was a murderer. Remember that Amnon, Absalom's half-brother, raped Absalom's sister Tamar, took her against her will, and the story is in 2 Samuel 13. I'm not going to read through that because of the time. Jonadab, who was David's nephew, sort of sympathized with his cousin Amnon's passion for her, and he gave Amnon the idea. He said, "Hey, just go act like you're sick, and then have David send Tamar in to take care of you, and then when Tamar's with you, then you can have your way with her." And so that's just what happened. Absalom learned about this, learned about what had happened to Tamar, and he took her in, and he advised her to be quiet about it because Amnon was her brother, and she stayed in the house of Absalom. But for 2 years, Absalom's hatred brewed, and he hated Amnon. And then at the end of that 2 years, he took his revenge. Just to keep the story short, he took his revenge. He had all of his men kill Amnon. And he fled. He fled to live with his grandfather, whose name was Talmai, who was the king of Geshur, which was a neighboring nation. And he hid there for 3 years. And after a while, he wanted to come back. Joab made efforts to get Absalom to come back home, to return to Jerusalem. Finally, David conceded. Absalom came back home. But David would not allow him to see his face. He said, you can go live in your own house, but you can't come and see me. And Absalom felt like, well, I might as well be living in Geshur if I can't even come before the king, because he knew he didn't have the king's approval, didn't have the king's blessing. And he tried to get Joab's attention so he would go and talk to David. Joab kept ignoring him, so he burnt Joab's fields down. You might remember that story. And Joab came to him, and he said, I want to see my father. And so he manages to create a way for David and Absalom to get together. And David received him back. And at least to some degree, he accepted him back into maybe his good graces. He kisses him. They are reconciled. In chapter 14 and verse 33. And so that seems kind of good, but Absalom asked David a favor then. He says, I really need to go to Hebron. He says, because when I was in Geshur, I made a vow. And so I need to go to Hebron. No, wait just a minute. Did I skip one there? First of all, he conspires against his father. Let me get this in the right order. He comes back to Jerusalem, and he sits outside the gate. Sits outside the gate of the city, and as people start going to the gate, and they're going to go to David, maybe to petition him, bring their problems, he sort of get intercepted by Absalom. And for 4 years, he sat outside the gate in Jerusalem. And he would say, listen, he said, you've got a good and just case. That's a good case. But you're not going to find any help in there. Just ask me, though. I'll give you justice. I'll answer these questions for you. This part of the story is in chapter 15. And Absalom really created the appearance of somebody very, very well-to-do. He had chariots and horses and 50 men that ran before him. And so he looked sort of like someone who might have some capacity to be an official. And for 4 years he did that. And he would tell people, if you would appoint me king, I will give you justice. And it says in verse 4 that he won the hearts of the people. He won the hearts of the people. So he conspires to take the throne away from his father. He is a murderer, and now he's conspiring against his father. I think David, it's hard to believe that David wasn't aware of what his son was doing for 4 years. Maybe he did have some suspicions, but he didn't want to believe it. After that time, he petitions David. He said, I made a vow while I was in Geshur, and I need to go fulfill it. I have to go to Hebron to do that. So David says, okay, go ahead. You have my blessing. So he goes to Hebron, and this is in chapter 15 and down in verse 7. He says, after it came about at the end of 4 years that Absalom said to the king, please let me go and pay my vow which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. But he really didn't have a vow to fulfill. What he really had in mind was to launch his conspiracy against David. And so when he went to Hebron, he betrayed his father, and he began a movement to take the kingdom away from David. And so in verse 10 it says, Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel and said, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, and you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron, And he says 200 men who were with him, with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited, went innocently, and they didn't know anything. And then Absalom calls for Ahithophel, who was another help, David's counselor, and Ahithophel joins a conspiracy. And then when David learns about it, it's too late. I mean, the conspiracy is well enforced. There are men. He's gathered men. He's stolen the hearts of the people. And David has to run. I mean, he has to flee from Jerusalem. Again, remember, this is his son who's doing this to him. So David leaves. And just look with me at chapter 15 and verse 13. This is a moving passage. It said, a messenger came to David and said, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. So David's thinking about the city and the good of the city. And the king's servant said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever the Lord, my lord, the king chooses. And so the king went out with all his household with him. But the king left 10 concubines in the house. And then down in verse 23, it says, and all the country was weeping with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. And the king also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. And then down in verse 30, in verse 30 it says, and David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot, and all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Well, I wonder, there probably is no picture next to the one of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane more moving and more sad than maybe of David here, who's fleeing from his own son. He's going down the slopes of Jerusalem and crossing the brook Kidron and climbing the Mount of Olives. And his head is covered and his feet are bare and his heart is broken and he's full of tears. And I wondered if perhaps there's not some irony in it that Jesus spent the night on the Mount of Olives after he was betrayed on this mountain by one of his own disciples. So again, when you think about this, Absalom was a murderer. He conspired against his father to take the kingdom away. He deceived his father when he went to Hebron to launch the campaign against him. Why would David be interested in him at all? Why would he even care about Absalom? Here's a man who had disgraced his father's family. He betrayed his father. He rebelled against his father's authority. He would sacrifice his father on the altar of his own interests and personal ambitions. And yet David, if you look in chapter 18, as David's army is assembled and he's having to put his army together and send his army out, he says to the generals that would lead the different regiments, he said, whatever seems best to you, I will do. He said, I'm going. And they said, no, you stay home. You stay there. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by the hundreds and the thousands. And the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, and he said, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. That's his last words to these generals as they go out to the fields to find Absalom. I don't think I can, but try to put yourself in David's shoes and imagine for a moment if you have a son and you're sending out 1,000 armed men to hunt down your son. And the first words to the messengers when they return from the battle with the news of how it went in chapter 18, and verse 29. And he said, is it well with the young man Absalom? And says, and Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I didn't know what it was. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. And he turned aside and stood still. Behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, let my lord the king receive good news. For the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite said, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. I don't know that there's a more powerful passage as you think about this situation. But this is the question that David raised. Is it well with the young man Absalom? And I want you to think about that question for a minute. First of all, was this a question that David asked too late? Should he have asked this question earlier? Because there's nothing he can do about it now. There was a time when something could have been done. And I want us to think about, do you know the time when he could have or should have been asking that question? I think he might should have asked that question when he was selecting Absalom's mother. You remember that Absalom, when he ran, he went to Geshur to stay with his grandfather. That's because his mother was not an Israelite, but she was from another land. In 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 2, it says, sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. And his second, he mentions these various sons. And when he gets to the third son, was Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. What was God's law to Israel concerning marriage for all Israelites? They were to marry from among their own people. David, I don't know why he married her. Don't know why he married Maacah. A lot of times kings did that for political reasons. They would strengthen themselves by making alliances with surrounding nations. But whatever it was, whatever the reason, he didn't trust God. Apparently, he didn't ask at that time, what kind of mother will this mother be for my son? Now he's asking, is it well with the young man Absalom? And it really wasn't looking very promising even from the birth of this young man. But the second time I think that David should have asked this question, is it well with the young man Absalom, is when he took Bathsheba and he killed Uriah. And we come to 2 Samuel chapter 11. You remember that story, I'm sure. He wrote a letter to Joab, the commander of his army, who was waging a war, I think it was against the Philistines. And in chapter 11 and verse 15, in this letter he had written, it said, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw him so that he may be struck down and die. Here's a man who is fighting for the safety of David's throne. He was selfless. He was loyal. This is Uriah. And he wouldn't even think of spending the night with his own wife when he came back home. And here is David wrecking this man's home by taking his wife and plotting his death. This is David. How could Absalom's future be safe when his dad was behaving like this? And so, to some degree, it was David's selfish ambitions who cost him his family. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 8 through 10, when God addresses David after all of that took place, he says, I gave you your master's house. I gave you your master's wives. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You've struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife. You've killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and you've taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. And behold, the Lord says, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. He said that the sword would never leave his home. And so David's selfish ambitions, at least in part, cost him his family. Going back to chapter 18 in verse 33. The king was deeply moved when the news came back to him. And he goes up to the chamber over the gate and he weeps and he says, Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you? Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. I wonder if David wasn't remembering that it was his own sins that at least in part brought Absalom to an early grave. Well, there's some applications that I think are useful when we think about this story. First of all, I want us, that is fathers and mothers who are here, to be asking the same question. Is the young man Absalom safe? Only I need to apply it to my own home. I need to say, is the young man, fill my son's name in, or my daughter's names in, are they safe? Well, is he safe as long as I'm not behaving myself as a Christian ought to behave? Is he safe when I'm too busy or too consumed by other things to spend time training him and working with him? Is he safe when I'm busy pursuing my own selfish ambitions, whether they're political or business or whatever my interests are? Is the young man safe when religion occupies just sort of a perfunctory secondary place in my life, a superficial thing in my home or my... Is my religion just going through the motions and not really from a devoted heart? Is my children safe if that's the nature of my worship to God? And I think if we don't operate with integrity and selfless devotion, sincere, deep, genuine devotion to God now, we may sometime down the road, like David, ask the question when it's too late to do anything about it. What's interesting is David was a man after God's own heart. That's the crowning statement of his character. That is what we remember David as. That fact ought to make us all the more humble. I'm sure there are Davids in this assembly, men that have a good heart, a heart just like God's. And yet David made some very foolish choices that had far-reaching consequences upon his children. And so, you know, the statement that Paul makes when he says, ye who, take heed ye that stand lest ye fall, is a good statement. Even for the best of the men, even the best of us who have good hearts, we have to think about the choices that we made, because there are consequences that come even to those who are the best of men. Well, somebody says, what if this happens to me? I mean, what then? Or maybe it has happened to some. What if a child is so far from home that he's either dead in his conscience or in his body, as it happened to Absalom? Well, there's different things that we can do. We can cry about it, and that's certainly appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. Who could deny a parent that right? Jesus cried over Jerusalem because of the sin there. Paul wept over his fellow countrymen who had rejected the gospel. And so that's something that's reasonable and would be expected to do. But the second thing is, don't let your weeping hinder you from your service to God. There's another part of the story that's important in chapter 19, 2 Samuel 19, verse 5 through 7. David was broken in his heart because of what had happened. Joab came to David, and Joab was certainly became a thorn in David's side. But he did give him good counsel and good advice. Verses 5 through 7 says, Joab came to the house of the king. And the king had, verse 4 had said, he covered his face, he cried out with a loud voice, "Oh my son Absalom, my son. So he's weeping and he's mourning, and this has been going on for a period of time. And Joab came to the house of the king, and he said, "Today you've covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who you hate and by hating those who you love. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now therefore arise and go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you don't go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." I think Joab probably gave David some good advice in that circumstance. He said, you know, "David, you're bringing everybody else down too. Is it good to constantly brood over a fallen child that you ruin both your happiness and everybody else's around you?" And Joab says, "You need to get up, and you need to realize that you're hurting other people as well by what's broken your own heart." And verse 8, we realize that there were other people that needed David's love and his blessings, his direction as well. It says, "So the king arose and sat in the gate, and when they told all the people, saying, 'Behold, the king is sitting in the gate,' then all the people came before the king." Everybody loved David. It may have looked like Absalom stole their hearts, but they quickly returned to their first love, to the one who had truly given himself to them. David couldn't let grief over the loss of one cause him to lose others as well, because he forgot them. And neither can we. I think the church needs you. Other parents need you. There are other people that suffer tragedies that you could comfort. There are those you could warn, maybe, that you see making the same mistakes. You know, sometimes when we make mistakes like that, our tendency to be self-justifying and say, "I didn't do anything. It's, you know, I did it all." It's more helpful when we're humble and we see our mistakes, and then when we see others making those mistakes, we say, "Hey, let me tell you, this could lead to something that you don't want." There are lost people, if the loss of a child can deepen our compassion for lost souls, then that should motivate us to work. So we should let God turn our grief into a blessing to others. And then somebody might, like David, say, "Well, I just can't. I just can't do it. I'm too broken. My spirit is broken. I'm so down. I'm so confused. I just can't be a Christian anymore." And that certainly happens. That certainly happens. Well, now you're the prodigal. Now you're the one who's left his father in heaven. I think it's interesting in this story that God doesn't let David have permission to stop being a zealous servant because he failed badly at times. And he doesn't give us permission to stop serving him either. Well, the song that I want to ask Mo to lead for us is the one that God is calling the prodigal. That's the, I think, a good song. It's a pattern for those of us who are parents, and the attitude we should have toward the Absaloms of today. There's a song that, another song that I used to hear when I was a kid called "Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree." My dad had these very old albums. They certainly came before my time. But he would listen to me. I'd hear those songs, you know, sometime around the house. And it told the story about a boy who had left his parents and been unfaithful to God. There's a story. And he had left home and he lived a life of crime and he wound up in prison for a long time. And just before he was released, he wrote a letter to his parents. And he said to them, "I've shamed you. I've mistreated you. I was gone when you needed me to be there with you. I've disgraced the family name." And he said, "I want to come home. I want to come home. But I can understand full well why you wouldn't want me back. I'm catching a train at a certain time, that will bring me right by the old farm, and there's an apple tree right by the railroad. If you want me to come home, tie a ribbon around the apple tree. But if you don't want me to come home, don't adorn the apple tree, and I'll understand. And the story goes, as the boy began to approach the farm on the train, he was so moved with emotion that he told a companion, "We're approaching the farm. I can't stand to look. But when we go by the apple tree, tell me if there's a ribbon around it." And as they passed by, he said, "Yes, there is a ribbon around the apple tree. But there's also a ribbon around every other tree in sight." And that's the attitude, I think, of God. Only he didn't tie a ribbon around a tree. He hung his son on a tree. And he stands there forever to tell us that if we fall away, that we can come home. And when you think about that, how could parents be bitter if one child wants to come home and live right? Surely God's attitude toward us should be our attitude toward them. Tonight, maybe you're an Absalom. Some of us may have found ourselves in that position before, and you want to come home to your Father in heaven, and he's made a way. It says, "He who confesses his sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us of all of our sins." There are people here to receive you. Because in one sense, we're all Absaloms. We all left our Father at one point and went into the world, and he's made a way for us to come back home. If you would respond to that invitation tonight, then the Father would welcome you back as we stand and sing our song.